Okay, just behind time, we're going to begin the check net. I'm K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick. Let's see if we got, we got the Eastern working. Hopefully we've got the Echo Link working in both directions, though that's not sure, and IRLP. The TechNet has been meeting ever since 1982. Curious radio amateurs gather at this time and teach each other how wireless equipment works, because the books do a mediocre job, the classes that teach wireless and radio do a mediocre job. They sometimes make it much more complicated than it has to be. If you really want to know somebody that, if you really want somebody that understands radio, you hire a ham radio operator, because it's in his blood. He lives it. He touches it. He talks to his fellow radio amateurs and compares notes, and they get to a higher truth about radio equipment most of the time, not always. There are a number of crazy theories that ham radio operators have, like a tremendous number of ham radio operators think that each UHF connector and each type N connector has half a dB of loss. Absolutely not. In coaxial cable-like structures, the only thing that has loss is something that's got a lot of resistance to it, or a lot of length to it, like 100 feet of cable. That's going to have some loss. But a connector that's 3/4 of an inch long with fancy laboratory equipment, the loss measured is something like 0.02 dB. It's something extremely small. Lots and lots of guys are thinking that if they change the two UHF connectors on their Mirage amplifier to type N connectors, they're going to pick up half a dB on each connector of improvement in performance. Nice thing to believe, but it's not true. That just gives you an example. How do antennas really work? How do coaxial cables really work? What does a Smith cock do? What is a... what really is standing wave ratio? What's going on there? Why does it happen? And so on. These are the kind of things we discuss. We teach each other. Not everything we say, let me drop. Not everything we say is 100% accurate. But it's kind of a post-event peer-reviewed material. Everything that's on the TechNet gets recorded at a website called amateurradio.tangovictor. And you go there, you can read all the past 10 years worth of TechNet. So when we say something wrong, somebody reviewing that material lets us know about it, and on the next week we let you know what mistakes we've made. And there are times we've made mistakes. Any reasonable engineer knows he doesn't bat a thousand. Nobody is 100% accurate all the time, no matter how hard you try. We all make mistakes occasionally. Okay. The way the TechNet is broken down into three sections. The first section is where people sign in because they do have a question or a comment. They give me and Roy and Paul their call letters, their name, and the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment. You may not sign in because you're listening. After 36 years of the TechNet, 4 hours every Sunday night for most of the 36 years, after that amount of time, we believe somebody is listening. It doesn't have to be proven anymore. The second section of the TechNet is Roy AC2GS. Dr. Roy gives us the mailbag and science talk. And he does have a real mailbag question tonight, which you might be interested in, about lightning. The third section is Paul WS2N tells us the space report. As you know, 60 satellites were all launched by one vehicle recently. He'll be telling us a little bit more about that. So, at this time, you guys who do have a question or a comment are going to sign in. You're going to give me your call letters, your name, try to remember to give me your name, and the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment, and try to remember to wait for the beep so we don't time out the machine. K2 Romeo India Whiskey, we're listening for check-ins.
AC2 RIW.
Okay, that was a double. I heard KC2 blank. Give me the KC2 again.
KC2, Mike Delta Papa, Steve, and yes.
We got you, Steve. Who was the other person that was checking in?
K2RIW, this is M2AAM, November 2, Alpha Alpha. Mike, Dave, yes.
Okay, we got you, Dave. Good sign in. So, so far we've got Steve and Dave. Anyone else to check in because you do have a question or comment? Give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes at this time.
2VBN, Sky 1, yes, 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 question.
Yes.
I heard KB2VBN doubling with somebody that said yes. The person who said yes, give me your call letters and name, sir.
WA2MHL, Bob, yes.
Okay, we got you, Bob. And KB2VBN, when we come back to you, will you still be there? There's lots of times you check in. We come back to you a half hour later and you're gone. Will you be there when we come back to you?
Yes. I got the whole week from vacation, so I don't have to go to sleep tonight.
Okay. And VBN, I should know your name. Please tell me your name.
Freddie, like in Flintstones.
Very fine, Freddie. One last call. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name and the word yes at this time. You've got more than enough to get going. Steve, KC2, Mike Delta Papa. Go right ahead with your question or comment, Steve.
Thank you, Dick. Good evening to everyone. I got a simple one tonight, Dick. You know the 12-volt sealed gel cell batteries? Are those things truly sealed, or are there still a dent on them? And the reason I ask is I looked on YouTube that these guys are reviving these car batteries. They're reviving gel cell batteries with UPS by putting like baking soda and water and everything else in them and then recharging them up, you know, to supposedly revitalize them. And to me, that's kind of a no-no. I would imagine that the gel is in there for a reason so it doesn't leak out. And I looked on the internet, and some say they're vented, some say they're aren't. So I'm throwing it out to you and everyone on the net. Thanks, Dick.
I'm going to give my opinion on this one, Steve. And after that, I'll throw it over to the net to see you guys who are smarter or what you think. A gel cell battery, some brands, I believe, are completely sealed. I think there's no vent on some of them, but there's a catch. If you overcharge it at some ridiculous rate after it's fully charged and you're still continuing to charge it, you're starting to develop a gas. And the sealed gel cells supposedly have a chemistry in there that can absorb some of the gas. But there's a certain point beyond which if you really overdid it, I think you could create an overpressure in there without a release valve. I think you'd have an explosion. Other than that, I think there might be some brands that have a release valve, but the release valve only happens when there's a high pressure because you've done something drastic. So most of the time, I believe gel cells are thoroughly sealed. And I think some of the gel cells claim that they can be mounted in any position. That would also suggest they're well sealed, otherwise something would be leaking out. Anybody who's got some more information about gel cell batteries and whether or not they're sealed, give us your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, you've heard an opinion. You'll probably be doing some more research and maybe some web searches on this one, Steve. As you find out more about gel cells and how well they are completely sealed, if they are, when you find that out, please come back and let us know what you find. KC2MDP, K2RIW, are you about to mount one in a place where you're afraid that if it leaked it would give you some trouble? Over to you, Steve.
No, not at all, Dick. As far as playing with those things, especially in the house, I'll just go out and buy a new one. Like I said, I read this, you know, I've seen these videos on YouTube where these guys, you know, they, one guy basically cleans the battery out and he puts Epsom salts, solution of Epsom salts water with the acid back into the battery. That kind of scares me. And then another guy says he actually peels the cap off these sealed gel cells and adds water into them and then charges them back up. And he says he's got, you know, great success rate with them. And, you know, like you said, you can mount these things sideways. You know, it all depends on how the UPS is. And I'm just afraid that this, you know, the solution, you put water in there, it's going to leak out if there's any kind of vent. Back to you.
Yeah, I'm not in favor of taking one of those things apart, because no matter how you put it back together, it's not going to be the same. And it's potentially capable of leaking. And if you've used it a whole lot of times and it's now lower in capacity or it's not behaving the way it should, and you think just by pouring in the right kind of chemistry you're going to get good operation out of it, there's an amazing number of people who claim that you can take a dead car battery and do certain things to it and bring it back to life. Well, you can get a little bit more life out of it, but they really do wear down. They really do become unreliable. and they're not that expensive, so to speak. A car battery, if your car is treating it correctly, you may have to only replace it once every 3, 4, or 5 years. And it's not that big an expense compared to all the other repairs you do on an automobile. So buying a new one of a respected brand name is the right thing to do. I think you're going to pour some exotic chemistry in there and get great operation out of it. I'm doubtful. But that's a bunch of opinions. I tried some of those experiments in my youth, and I thought I was getting some benefit for a little while, but in the big picture, I think I was overly biased in my ratings of what was going on. Back to you for any final, Joe. KC2MDP. K2IW. You got it, Steve.
Very good, Dick. Yes, I'm with you. Yeah, there's this one guy, you know, I commented, and he commented back to me that, oh, it only costs him $3 to revive these batteries, and, you know, and I basically said, well, you know, basically once you kill a battery, you know, it's never going to charge to full potential, and his comeback was, well, you know, it's working, and, you know, I basically said, well, you know, when it's going to go dead on you, when it's 0 degrees out in a snowstorm, and you're not going to be too happy with your $3 battery. Back to you.
Now, one of the crazy characteristics of a lead-acid battery is that if you discharge it beyond the 50% point, you're doing permanent damage. And whether or not you can do overcharging for a long period of time and bring it back to life is questionable. But even though you can get power out of it beyond the 50% point, in an emergency when you've got no choice, go do it. But you are permanently damaging it. The plates warp and the chemistry of the plates changes. So lead-acid batteries, the nice thing to do is don't discharge them beyond the 50% point. If it's rated for 50 ampere hours, don't go more than 25 ampere hours of discharge. And if you follow those rules, you may get an awful lot of years of life out of a lead-acid battery. Gel cell is a certain kind of lead-acid battery. Okay, we're going to move on to the next person, which was Dave, into Alpha Alpha Mike, I think it is. Go right ahead, Dave. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Okay, Dick, very good. This is N2AAM, Dave in Hasbrook Heights, New Jersey. Since I can't make it into the repeater, I'm in via Echolink. Now, I'd like to bring up an interesting historical perspective here. It is 2019, the 50th anniversary of the original moon landing takes place this year, and I know you had a connection with that, Dick, having monitored Apollo 11, or one of the Apollo's flights, from your location on Long Island. Just be interesting from a historical perspective for you to give maybe just a couple of minutes synopsis of what equipment you used to do it, what sort of modulation you got back from the spacecraft, things like that. Be interesting to know on this 50th anniversary of the Apollo mission. Over.
Yes, Apollo 11 was June, I think it was 1969. And like everybody else, I was watching it during the landing, and I heard the one small step for a man. One small step for man is what he really said. He eventually admitted that. One giant leap for mankind. It was a few launches downrange on Apollo 15 and Apollo 16 are the two that I listened to directly. I was working for Airborne Instruments Laboratory. I was part of the development team that developed the 707 Spectrum Analyzer, an AIL product. And it had a nice crystal-controlled front end that you could lock the local oscillator and listen to an S-band signal. The command service module of all the Apollo spacecraft was 2287.5 megahertz, 2.2875 gigahertz, so to speak. So by using the spectrum analyzer as a down converter and then taking the IF strip and eventually pouring it into a ham radio FM demodulator, I was able to listen to astronaut audio on both Apollo 15 and Apollo 16. So I was listening to the astronauts during times when they were not connected to the networks. So therefore, I was listening to some rather private conversations between them and Houston headquarters. After Apollo 16, I got invited to Houston, and I went to the Houston headquarters, Building 30, met astronaut Stuart Roosa and Deke Slayton, when I was introduced to Deke Slayton, he was unhappy to meet me because from his point of view, I was taking his very private radio network that he would allow. He was in charge of astronaut training, so he could talk to the astronauts. And from his point of view, this ham radio operator had set up equipment by which he was listening to the astronauts, and therefore I was tapping into his party line. So he wasn't happy to meet me. Let me drop this. You can read about the equipment that I used in the 1972 QST, let me think now, the April and May issue was the parallel kilowatt amplifier, the June issue and September issue, June, July, September, one of those issues shows the 12-foot parabolic dish that I made, homebrew, that listened to it, using a low-noise parametric amplifier that was an AIL product connected to the feed horn of this 12-foot dish. The 12-foot dish was mounted on a very large photographic tripod out in front of the building of the AIL. And as I said, the audio, the downlink was on 2287.5, was the main carrier. The astronaut audio was on a subcarrier, 1.25 megacycles. So if you listened 1.25 megacycles above and below the main carrier, you would hear astronaut audio, and I'd listen to one of those sidebands. I didn't have the right kind of a phase lock loop system at first, but I did hear astronaut audio with reasonable signal-to-noise ratio when they were on the high-gain antenna. I also listened to the lunar module when they landed. I also listened to some of the signals from the ALSEP packages, Apollo Lunar Surface Experimental Packages. So I was hearing all of those signals coming from the moon with this 12-foot dish with a parametric amplifier, and the antenna was 12-foot diameter, made out of window screening and 18 aluminum posts, aluminum pieces of tubing bent into a parabolic shape with a 135-pound Dacron fishing string. So that's the August issue, 1972 QST magazine, the 12-foot dish that we used to listen to that. The feed horn of the dish was made out of an American paint can and a Scottish oatmeal can because they had the right diameters for that frequency region. And I was listening to the circular polarization of the downlink, clockwise circular polarization. That gives you, and I got a couple of hours worth of audio on Apollo 15 and about 10 hours worth of audio on Apollo 16. As I said, some of it's relatively candid stuff. Over to you for any further questions on all of the above, Dave. N2AAM, how'd you find out about the fact that I did that? And by the way, when it comes to confirming whether or not the astronauts really did launch, land on the moon, one of the things that's sometimes quoted is the fact that this group of radio amateurs in Farmingdale, Long Island, listened to the signals directly coming from the moon. So it wasn't coming from Hollywood. They really did land there. Back to you, Dave. N2AAM, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very good. This is N2AAM. Well, I've been a space buff since I was a little kid in the 1960s, and a radio history buff as well. And I remember reading a couple articles about your exploits on the Internet, referring that you did it, but it didn't give that much information on how. And just one technical question regarding the modulation. I know later space missions converted to completely digital downlinks with TDRS and so on, TDRS repeating the 2 gigahertz signals at 10 gigahertz for satellite comms. But I assume that was before digital, so I guess the signal you were listening to was a wide bandwidth signal that I'm going to assume carried the video and telemetry, and the audio was a subcarrier off of that signal, ever?
The main carrier of the command service module, let me readjust this thing here. The main carrier of the command service module was on 2287.5. Phase modulated at 1.25 megacycles. The phase modulated signal at 1.25 megacycles had FM superimposed on it, analog FM, something like plus or minus a 7.5 kc, astronaut audio, and that's what I was listening to. another subcarrier when they turned on the video camera was used. I think that was 1.5 megs or something like that, another subcarrier for analog TV. I didn't have enough signal-to-noise ratio to listen to the analog TV. Steve Meath, can't think of his call letters, in California, he did get astronaut video downlink. He was using a better system than mine. I think he was using an 18-foot dish with a homebrew parametric amplifier. So I was only listening to audio. Later spacecraft on the Deep Space Network did use a lot of digital. Like you take, for instance, the Voyager. Is that one? Is that the ones I'm trying to think of? Paul, if you're listening, what's the name of those two spacecraft that are out there at 12 million miles? I can't think of the name. Is it Voyager or WS2N, K2IW? Give me the information, please.
Yeah, Voyager, Voyager 1, Voyager 2, WS2N. The ones that preceded it, they're gone too, but they're no longer operating. That was Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 are out there three times the distance to Pluto right now, traveling at something like 45,000 miles an hour away from us. And that is digital downlink. And the nice thing about that phase-modulated digital downlink is that you can make the data rate slower and slower as they get further and further away and the signal gets weaker and weaker. At 12 billion miles where the Voyagers are right now, Voyager 1 and 2, that distance gives you a free space loss of 317 decibels. That's a huge loss. The signal they get into an 85-foot dish, or is it a 250-foot dish, 245-foot diameter dish at Goldstone, California. And by the way, I visited that dish at Fort Irwin at Goldstone, California. The signal they get when they set the receiver to a bandwidth of 150 hertz, and that's the data rate, 150 bits per second, they can go to a slower and slower data rate by...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, Dick, very good. And that's fascinating. And thanks for the overview. Interesting thing on this 50th anniversary of the Apollo mission. And as far as anything else, that's about it. I've been a listener to the TechNet since back in 1982 when it was affectionately referred to as the Hip and Dick Show. So I go back a while, and you do a great job. Catch you later. Thanks for answering my question. This is N2AM clear and back to net.
Yeah, thank you, Dave. That was a good set of questions you asked. Right now, each of our presidents think they're going to make a big splash, just like President Kennedy did when in 1962 or 63, he said he's going to send people to the moon and bring them safely back to work, back to Earth. So we're going to send men back to the moon, we think. We keep forgetting about the fact that each of the landings on the moon, when you find out where they were, they landed at a very carefully spot on the moon where the moon was being illuminated by the sun at sundown, because the day on the moon is 28 days long. You got 12 consecutive days of high noon and 12 consecutive days of midnight, so to speak. So the temperatures on the moon go ridiculously high. 250 degrees Fahrenheit during the day and minus 250 degrees Fahrenheit at night. No astronaut can tolerate that amount of heat during the day or that amount of cold at night. But if you carefully choose the landing location just at sundown, where the temperature is more like 65 degrees Fahrenheit, then you can send the astronauts there for a couple of days maximum. So to send astronauts back to the moon, you've got to solve a huge problem. You've got to establish some kind of a habitat for them. Let me pick a number, 20 meters below ground where the temperature is more steady. On the surface, I can't think of any reliable hardware that you could use as a habitat that can tolerate those temperature extremes. So to simply say you're going to put man back on the moon, it's a very optimistic sounding thing. And for what purpose? The Apollo lunar landing missions altogether was $33 billion in 1970 money. that's going to be $100 billion today. And what do you get in return for doing that? And you're going to be putting your astronauts at ridiculous risk until you establish these habitats. And how are you going to put mankind there long enough to establish the habitat? You'd have to do it by remote control with digging equipment and assembly and housing assembly equipment. It's a big deal. So sending men back on the lunar surface as a colony sounds nice on paper, but I think your grandchildren are not going to see it happen. They're certainly not going to see them go to Mars. That's a bunch of opinions on my part. Good questions, Dave. Okay, Freddie next. WB2, VBN. If he's still there for this particular week, see if Freddie is there. Go ahead, Freddie. K2IW in the TechNet.
This is KB2, VBN. Yes, I have a question. Can a repeater survive during an F3 tornado? Can a repeater survive during an F3 tornado? And can the simplex work if you get by a tornado like that in an area?
Yeah, if we had a third-class tornado where all of our equipment mounted at Glen Oaks on top of those three buildings, would the buildings survive without a whole lot of damage? Would they still have electric power? Is there standby power? Would the antenna blow over? I think there's a 50-50 chance that the repeater might survive a tornado, but it might not. Who am I trying to think of who would know whether or not he thinks the repeater would survive? Does anybody have an opinion as to whether or not they think this repeater would survive a hurricane? Give me your call letters right now, K2IW.
Yeah, NY2H, I think they're gas fired. I think they have their own generators. I think they're permanently on gas, natural gas.
Yeah, for some reason I couldn't think of your call letters, couldn't think of your name, Lou. My mind went blank. So when it comes to standby generator power, yes. Do you think the antennas mounted at their base if the antenna had some kind of a support at the top, a station master antenna, yes, I think it can survive a hurricane. But if it's only mounted from the base and the top can swing back and forth 18 feet of it, I think you're going to crack that fiberglass radome in a tornado wind. What do you think, Lou? NY2H, K2IW?
Yeah, that's a possibility, but even if you crack it, unless the thing bends over, it falls apart. You'll have the collinear wire in there, but yeah, I guess that supports it. It's funny, because I had a 18-footer, and we took it down for a while and had it up against the trees, and it cracked. But I found this great tape. It's kind of repaired tape, and you dip it in water for 5 seconds, and then you wrap it around, and it hardens. It's like a cast. It's like an arm cast, almost. And it worked. We got the thing up there again. That was the quick fix for that.
KB2 GXM.
GXM, go ahead.
KRW in the group. This is WB2 Golf X-Ray Mike Rich. All right, Dick, is it possible for you to tell me exactly on what buildings the W2 video repeater is located? If you can't, I will understand. WB2GXO.
I'm going to pass that over to Lou. Lou, you want to answer that question? NY2H, K2LIW.
Gee, I don't know. it's for public consumption. A lot of people know where it is, but it's in the Nassau Queens border, just on the Nassau side. I think it's on the Nassau, maybe it's just on the Queens side, actually. Glen Oaks.
North Shore Tower?
Yeah, that's it.
Thank you.
We have like 33 floors plus a penthouse, and the property itself is a couple of hundred feet above sea level. I don't know if it's 300-400 feet above. Dick, maybe you know. So that plus 33 floors, or 34 floors, get some good elevation there.
I'm going to make a guess, Lou, that the top of that building is a healthy 500 or 550 feet above sea level. What do you think, Lou?
Yeah, I think that's in the ballpark.
And the good news is you've got some nice high altitude for radio propagation. The bad news is the wind up there is going to be considerably stronger. During Hurricane Gloria, for instance, I think my property experience, I'm going to pick a number, 85 miles an hour. But the top of my 100-foot tower, I know had over 100 miles an hour of wind. It bent the top of my tower. One of my towers was a Roan number 6 at the time, and the top 10-foot bent over at about a 30-degree angle. And straightening that out is a story in itself. So, the good news is the hurricanes on Long Island are relatively rare. But we get all kinds of damage during Hurricane Gloria. My goodness. Or Superstorm Sandy. There are a number of people who are without electrical power for more than a week and a half, and even 2 weeks in some cases. A lot of damage occurred during Hurricane Sandy. So, although you've got standby power, gas-powered generators for the building, still at a 550-foot altitude with the fierce wind you're going to get up there, I think there's going to be some antenna damage, even if all the equipment and the little equipment housing survives. That's a bunch of opinions. Back to you on that one, Bob. Yeah, I think it's Bob that was asking the question. WB2MHO, K2RIW. No, it was VBN. Sorry. Freddie, did you get a partial answer to your question, Freddie? Over to you, Freddie, VBN.
Yes. Tornadoes. Because there's a lot of tornadoes damaging in the Midwest. And I was wondering, man, how could people skip the repeaters in that kind of damage, man?
Yeah, of all the ham radio articles we've been reading lately, with all the flooding and hurricanes and tornadoes that are hitting the Midwest, we haven't been hearing much about the ham radio operators out there. I haven't read any articles on that subject. But during some of those weather disasters, emergency communication is certainly required. So we should have been hearing more about what the ham radio operators have been doing. Has anybody read any articles on that subject? Give me a call. That is right now. K2IW and the TechNet. I guess what people usually do is listen to a standard broadcast and listen to the hurricane warnings and start protecting themselves, going to a basement if they've got them, and sitting in their bathtub in the bathroom, covered over with a sheet of plywood if you have that ability, if you don't have a basement. So you got to do something when the house around you is crumbling. And to live in a mobile home is not a very safe place during a tornado. They get flattened real fast. So I don't think many of us want to move to the Midwest right now. I mean, the floodwaters they're getting in places like Arkansas. We see some of those pictures. Boy, that doesn't look like fun to see a farm and a farmhouse flooded with 3 or 4 feet of water everywhere. No fun. Anybody have any further comments? Give me a call. That is K2RIW.
This is in 2RQ.
Go ahead, Lou.
I have a related question and experience actually 6 years ago. By the way, I heard on Amateur Radio Newsline that the Hara Arena was demolished by one of the storms, but that the Hamvention, the current Hamvention site, was not so severely damaged. 6 years ago, I was driving south, I think on Route 81 or something like that, and we had the broadcast radio on, and for the first time in my life, I heard the broadcast station direct amateurs to the Skywarn repeater. And I was able to do that while driving. Terrific rainstorm. I wonder, is that common anywhere else? Certainly we haven't heard it here.
I missed a couple of key words. What is it? Was that happened during the storm that you experience and you wonder if anybody has experienced it here, please repeat that statement, Steve, I mean, Lou.
Broadcast station, I don't remember if it was AM or FM, came on with an announcement about a tornado watch in the area and directed amateur radio Skywarn operators to a particular repeater frequency, which we were able to do, and I checked into the net. But I have never heard of broadcast stations alerting the Skywarn operators that way. And I wonder how common that is.
Just like you, I've never heard that on the East Coast. I wonder if anyone else has. Maybe in the Midwest, where if you lived in Tornado Alley, you do certain things differently than you do in a place like where we live. Anybody got any further comments on this?
Yeah, Rich Collins, K2 UPS, is trying to get in from Echo Link also, so leave a pause here and let's see if what Rich has to say.
K2 UPS, go right ahead.
Okay, good evening, Dick. Thanks, Luke, for clearing that. K2 UPS mobile in Ohio at the moment. I was actually driving through the Columbus area that evening when the tornadoes went through the Dayton area. That was no joke. That was some storm. But the one thing that they keep in mind with tornadoes, too, is it's not just the extremely high winds, but it's the degree that it's in those winds. Just like when you get a tidal wave, it's not so much heat, but the force of the water. It's all of the degree that the water picks up that does a lot of the damage. But you could have an antenna that might be rated at 100 miles an hour or 20 miles an hour, but if it picks up a garbage can a little bit, the wind, and something relatively small hits it at that speed, it's going to just snap it right in half. And I'm sure you've seen photos where there's been, like, a drinking straw driven through wood from the force of the wind. So it's not just the wind, but the fact that you have high wind. It's all the debris that is in the wind.
I do see, I did hear on the news that Dayton, Ohio was pretty heavily hit, and you were driving through that area, and there were a few tractor-trailer trucks that got blown over on their side. What was the wind like that you experienced, and were you worried about whether or not your vehicle would be blown over? In which case, I guess I would try to aim the nose of the vehicle into the wind if possible. K2 UPS, K2 RIW, go ahead, Rich.
As far as trying to aim the truck into it, it's not as easy as that sounds. Maybe you ought to help you get through it. I don't know what the wind speeds were when we drove through, but it's extremely heavy rain. There was some hail at one point. The truck was rocking and rolling. Thank goodness both of the trailers were fully loaded. If we had empties, it might have been different. I don't like, and more and more frequently, I'd say in the last 2 months, I've probably had about 10 different alerts of severe weather and tornadoes in your vicinity alerts come across my cell phone, and I hate getting those. That's not fun.
When you're experiencing that very high wind and hail and very heavy rain, my guess is you don't drive at 60 miles an hour through that. You probably slow down quite a bit. Is that true, Rich?
Definitely. Definitely. There was times I was probably maybe only doing 20 miles an hour with the four-way on. You don't really want to come to a complete stop if you can avoid that, because then somebody might rear-end you if they don't see you. But it's unfortunately, when it gets that bad, most of the cars get off the road. But there really isn't any safe place to get to. You know, if it's going to hit you, it's going to hit you. But there's not many places I can hide a 75-foot vehicle and make it safe out of the weather, unless it was a nearby tunnel.
What do you believe, Lou, was the highest wind that you experienced during any of those events? And sounds to me like, what, 4 or 5 times you had some of these tornado warnings where you were driving? Go ahead.
I've probably been in 60 to 70 mile an hour wind before, and I've seen the tail trailer start to tip over in a really strong crosswind, but I've never actually lost control of the rig or had anything disastrous happen. but I've come through areas shortly after a tornado has passed through, and it's just amazing to see the damage that it could do. It could be so fine at almost pinpoint. It could be a swath only 100 feet wide, and it could be a quarter of a mile or more wide. It's very strange how that happens. But I've seen it just take a bunch of trucks parked side by side in a truck stop and just mix them up like a bunch of kids' toys ducked out of a box. I know there was one case. There was a team operation, drivers pulling two trailers. Tornado hit them, it separated the tractor from the two trailers and slammed it down upside down between them. And I believe the driver that was in the sleeper berth killed the driver that was actually doing the driving at the time and seriously injured. To pick up a vehicle like that, just toss it around, that gives you some idea of the power it has. And you see some of these newscasters and weathermen going out there, and they're trying to hang on and show you what it's like. You ain't hanging on, and those kind of wind. Not like it goes over the head.
Two, Bravo Zulu, comment.
Bravo Zulu, go ahead.
With you, two, Bravo Zulu, my name is Rich. It's amazing that almost everybody to a person over the years when they're being interviewed after one of these things go through says the same thing. Says, it sounds like a freight train. They don't say anything else other than that. So the commonality just always blows my mind that's the reference they use. And Dick, when you get some, if you have some extra time, I have another question on another topic. Go ahead.
M2EO comment.
Okay, Bravo Zulu, recognized. M2EO, go ahead with your comment.
Yes, a number of years ago, living in Whitestone, there were tornadoes. I heard something. I was in the bedroom with the computer, and just that sounded like a freight train. The funnel went right open. But the funnel never came down to the ground. Because there was no destruction. But down the street, some trees were torn up, and a lady in a convenience store at the Exxon Mobil station, lives down by the water, said there were water spouts.
Very fine, Rich. Rich number one, K2UPS, when that wind blows real fast that you're driving, did you ever have the problem where it was a sideways wind and you ended up changing lanes when you didn't desire to do that? K2UPS, K2RISE. And one other question, I think they tell you never park your vehicle under an overpass. You think you're going to get protection, but I guess the wind can whistle through there and get amplified. You might have an opinion on that. K2UPS, K2RIW.
Hey, yeah, I remember hearing they would tell you, like, if you're at your car, the safest place is to go and crawl underneath an overpass, and that's the proof that that's not the safest place to be. You want to find, like, a ditch or whatever, and just get as low as possible you can to the ground, and that flying debris doesn't hit you. But if something lands on you, it's, the time is up, the time is up, you can't always avoid stuff. But yeah, I've had some extremely strong crosswinds coming up through Ohio, heading between Cincinnati and Columbus, and it was coming out of the east, but it was hitting the passenger side of the vehicle extremely strong, probably 50 miles an hour at least, and it was pushing my rear trailer halfway into the left lane. So the only way to proceed was I had to drive in the left lane so that my rear trailer was now over in the shoulder. There was nothing else to, there was no safe place to get off the road at that point. It was just, if I stayed in the right lane, it would be a two-lane road, two lanes in each direction. I was too afraid that it was going to take off somebody next to me, so I just rode the left lane until we got out of that area, cleared that up. I didn't think the other troopers didn't bother. They had their own headaches stuff that day anyway, I guess. So, you see a lot out here.
And Y2H with a comment.
Go right ahead, Lou.
So if you're in the vehicle, in a ditch, low to the ground, do you have your engine on or off, Dick? This is a riddle.
and on, you make sure you've got power to run radios and whatever, without running down the battery, air conditioning. I can't see any advantage in turning the engine off, but you probably got more information on this, Lou. Over to you, Lou.
So this is something I've heard, and I want the fact checkers out there to fact check it. I heard that you should have the engine on so that if debris comes, your airbags will deploy. Apparently your airbags will not deploy if the engine is off. I don't know if that's true. And then someone else anteed up and said, well, it probably has to be on and in drive. So I'm not sure when they're engaged, when they're not engaged, but what I did hear on a TV station was you should have your engine on so that if debris comes your way, and if necessary, the airbags will deploy.
Makes sense that the it does make sense that the airbags might be disconnected when the ignition is off, because I can see a repair station doing a repair of your bumper, so to speak, and using a impact wrench, and with the key turned off, you wouldn't false alarm the airbag system. That's just a guess. Rich, when you had the trailer move up at least half a lane, were you towing two trailers? Were you a tandem trailer at that time? In which case, wow. K2UPS, K2LIW.
K2UPS, that's correct. It was two trailers, and it was the rear trailer, second trailer. That was the one the end was over.
So in other words, that wind was strong enough to push your tires sideways on the trailer. I presume each trailer has a total of eight wheels, and you were pushing those eight wheels, making them drift sideways. I guess if you got the good tread on those tires, the tread will squirm enough to allow that to happen without them truly sliding sideways on the pavement. Does that approximate what was happening? Over to you, Rich, KQIW.
It wasn't raining at the time. It was just very strong winds, but I don't know how much the tread was helping or hindering the effect, but it was definitely happening. After about 30, 35 miles an hour, you usually keep it all together, or when you get some pretty strong gusts coming in, and that's when it was about to kick over, and I just couldn't take the chance that that I'd hit somebody next to me. So I just rode the left lane, let them pass me on the right.
Rich, what do you believe is the maximum crosswind you can tolerate? My guess is anything beyond 50 miles an hour starts getting real.
Things are rated at, but I wouldn't want to be driving too much more than 50 to 60 mile an hour wind. That's pretty rough. Headwind is one thing, but coming at you from the side, particularly when I can gust it, if you're getting hit from the side, well, you are. I mean, the wind's hitting you, but if you comes out all the way, and you got to make sure you got a good grip on the steering wheel, or you're going to lose it.
When you were getting those crosswinds that were blowing your trailer off to another lane, was that a steady wind, or was it very gusty? Over to you, Rich.
Steady 20 to 30 mile an hour wind, with gusts as high as 50. And one thing that didn't help was that my rear trailer was not fully loaded, and it also had side skirts on it. You've seen a lot of the trailers nowadays, they're all they're putting different devices on them to make them more aerodynamic and save fuel. Some of them are these skirts that extend the side of the trailer down almost to the ground. Others are scoops underneath the trailer to try to direct the air around the axles. Then they also have the trailer, they call them trailer tails, but these extensions that stick out the back of the trailer to try to create or reduce the suction, the vacuum behind there that pulls to reduce the drag on it so you save fuel. But the trailer that's pulling that day had side skirts on them, so the wind couldn't get under the trailer. I don't know if that made it more pressure pushing on it, or if the wind was able to get under it, if it would have tried to lift it. I don't know.
Yeah, I can see the possibility that those skirts would increase the amount of side force from a crosswind, which would increase the probability of you being tilted over to another lane. Huh. So you've had to drive in those conditions, what, about five times in this year so far, Rich, go ahead.
I wouldn't say it was five times a year. I've had multiple times where my phone has gone off alerting me that there's going to be a severe storm that had any or in my area or and or a tornado warning in the area. But the really severe weather, like I described, that one was about a year and a half ago maybe in Ohio. I haven't had too many times like that, certainly not this year anyway, at least, that I've had to drive through. But you know, when the visibility gets down to where you can't see much more than 50 or 100 feet due to heavy rain, that's when you just have to pull over and wait it out.
Interesting. Have you actually seen, looking out the window, have you actually seen a tornado, Rich? My guess is maybe you were lucky and never actually saw one in the distance. Is that true?
KTUPS. I have seen them in the distance before, both in my private vehicle and in a truck down in Texas, Oklahoma, in that area. But we did have one probably about 8 years ago or so, cross I-80 in Pennsylvania, right around mile marker 90-91. The tornado passed, crossed the road in front of us, and we couldn't see it because there was so much precipitation and wind-blown leaves and sticks and stuff that you couldn't really see much more than about 50 feet, so we couldn't actually see the funnel cloud, but it passed right across the road, and the next day when we went through that area, you could see all the trees that were literally ripped out of the ground, including the roof wall, and immediately after it passed through, when we drove through that area, you couldn't see any pavement. Everything was covered with green leaves and branches. No matter where you looked, you couldn't see any road surface.
Wow. You've seen a lot. You spent a lot of time on the road, and therefore you've seen an awful lot of this jazz. I guess I've run out of questions. Let's see if anyone else has any further questions for you. Give me a call, Livers, right now. K2IW in the TechNet.
Comment on the airbags, KC2, SC2.
Go right ahead, John.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. K2IW, KC2, SHO. Done a while back here in the 90s. Used to tear apart a lot more cars. I had a bunch of, like, Taurus SHOs. My brother was a Ford mechanic, and I'm pretty sure, I may need to look this up, but just again, go my memory here, sitting with the cat on my lap, not looking online and clarify any of this, but that airbag system, I believe, is fully independent of the car's power. When you take those connectors apart, they even have a self, there's only two wires in each sensor, and on the airbag too, I believe, at least that's the way it was in a 90s Taurus. And I believe the impact causes a voltage to be generated and deploys the airbag. I believe it's completely independent of the 12-volt system. And again, when you take those connectors apart, there's a self-grounding conductor in there, a self-shorting conductor in there that when the connector is taken apart, it shorts those two wires together, so you can't accidentally, like with a static shock or something like that, engage the airbag system when you're working on a car. And I was warned to be very careful with that by my brother, who was a factory-trained Ford technician as well. So, may not be completely accurate here, but I just thought I'd pass on my old memories from the days of tearing apart old cars. And new cars may be completely different as well. Who knows? K2IW, KC2, SHO.
E2FIU.
George recognized, but stand by a minute, sir, George. John, if there's a two-wire connector connected to the airbag, where do those two wires go if they're not part of the electrical system of the automobile? Back to you, John.
There are impact sensors around, they're not even sensors. They are a deployer, if you will. If you hit one of those with a hammer, I believe it generates an electric charge somehow. And I do not believe something like an impact gun would set those off. I don't think that has the right kind of, you really need a solid impact, something that sends a serious shockwave through the car. K2RW, KC2, SHO.
Hi, thank you, John. FIU, go ahead, George.
Thank you, Dick. I'm just a little worried here as to, or concerned as to why when we turn the ignition on, we're waiting for a deployable indicator to tell us that the airbags are working. And that indicator would not, in some models, not let us start the car, and in some models just run an engine warning light. So I don't know whether it's just an electrical charge. So the fact is, if you have it off and you have your ignition switch in the total off the switch position, are the airbags deployable? It's not whether the engine is running. It's where the ignition switch is. That's kind of a question I'm in. I'm not advising. That's where my question is. Because we have that deployability warning that goes, that is arrested, so to say, after a few seconds, whether the engine is turning or not.
NY2H.
Yeah, I see the possibility of a built-in test function where the automobile computer tests the operability of the airbags without actually firing them. Maybe they are independent by an accelerometer fires them, and the accelerometer is built into the airbag. That's a guess on what we've been hearing up to now. Let's see what Louis got to say. NY2H, K2LIW.
I found this website, Polk McGlamory. They're attorneys at law, and they're involved in these suits. You know, GM had defective ignition switches. And what it says here is, if the car is turned off, so are the airbag sensors. And defective ignition switches have been responsible for numerous accidents in which there was no deployment of the airbags due to the defect in the ignition switch. So apparently, the sensors are powered and switched on and off via the ignition switch.
Well, there's another possibility here. There could be an accelerometer built into the airbag assembly, which makes the airbag assembly deploy when you exceed a certain accelerometry, and the automobile has a built-in test telling you that that system is operatable, even though it might not be supplying the power for its operation. That's a bunch of guesses on my part. Anybody got any further comments? K2LIW.
2FIU.
Go ahead, George.
I think Lou worded it a little bit differently what I was getting at. The car totally shut off. You don't deploy the airbags. You cannot deploy the airbags with the ignition switch off.
Okay. Then although the airbag might still have an independent accelerometer that fires it, a signal from the ignition being on creates an enabled function that might not actually supply the power to deploy. It might supply the power to create an enable. I mean, an example of this is on Apollo 11, when they were supposed to leave the moon, the toggle switch that enabled the rocket engine, that toggle switch, the little bat handle had broken off, and what the astronaut did was to take a fountain pen apart, stick it in the hole, and flip that switch to the enabled position. Thank goodness he can do that. If he hadn't done that, they'd still be on the moon. Any further comments? K2RIW in the TechNet.
82FIU.
Go ahead, George.
Need a little bit of a safety factor to be able to work on the automobile, and especially in the interior. as a simple disabling of the airbags, having the ignition switch off, so that